This is disc number 12.
If anyone had told Zed that he would someday make such an agreement with a moored Sith over something so important, he would have thought that they were crazy. He was grateful that such things had changed for the better. Chapter 34. It's a complex route, Zed told her. Rika arched an eyebrow. Have you ever had to come find me because I got lost patrolling the keep? Zed realized that he hadn't. He knew very well how easy it was to become lost in the keep. In fact, that was one of its defenses. In several places, when trying to travel through the keep, one came upon interconnected rooms numbering in the thousands. In those places, there were no hallways except for the stairs going up or down. Passage through those three-dimensional mazes was necessary to get into several well-protected areas. It was deceptively easy to become lost forever in the morass of those interconnected rooms. Even people who had grown up in the keep could easily become lost in there. An invader, unfamiliar with the place, and if they went too deep into the labyrinth, faced a formidable challenge just to find their way back out, much less to make a passage all the way through and then to escape. Once you had been through a few rooms, through a few doorways, it was amazing how similar everything looked. There were no windows to help, and direction soon became meaningless. There was virtually no way to tell if you recalled seeing a room or a doorway before. One looked much like the last dozen you'd seen. There had been spies and such in the past, who had become lost in the maze of rooms. In ages past, it had not been entirely unusual to find a body in there. Of course, not all those who intended harm were strangers. In the past, some had been traitors.
No, I guess you never have become lost, Zed finally agreed. Not yet, anyway. You've not been here long enough to begin to explore the majority of the place. There are dangers of every sort. Getting lost in the labyrinth, that is, the keep, is only one of the perils. Where we're going is like that. It's even easier to get lost down there. You will have to do your best to remember your way. I'll help you where I can.
Rika nodded, seemingly unconcerned. I'm good at remembering things like a series of turns. I memorize them when I patrol.
Don't get overly confident. This is more complex than a series of turns. I myself have become lost in the keep, and I grew up here. There is not only one right way to get where we're going. Sometimes the route you took the last time won't work this time because down in the lower reaches of the keep, the shields sometimes shift by themselves to different passageways. It's part of their design to make it more difficult to get through. For instance, if a spy were to draw a map for their cohorts.
Unimpressed, Rika shrugged. I understand. The people's palace is like that in some of the sections where the public isn't allowed. Complex. With the open passages, one can get through changing from time to time. Additionally, there is no direct route to anywhere, even if all the passages happen to be open, which they never are.
I remember. I was there before, although I was in the public sections. But that was confusing enough.
It had been after Dark and Rawl had captured Richard.
I had the advantage, though, in that the people's palace is made in the form of a spell drawn on the face of the ground, and I know how that particular spell is constructed. So I know where the primary arms and the connecting links are located.
Well, Rika said, we had to be able to find different passages through the place so that we could get from area to area if it was ever invaded. Or if we are chasing someone, we had to be able to think of a way to get ahead of them. We have to be able to do more than simply remember a series of turns. We must comprehend the whole of the place we pass through. In my head, the turns I take make up parts of a picture of a place. Every turn adds to that picture. With that ever-growing image in my mind, I can find my way by taking a different way because I can see where the other parts are and how they lock together. Zed blinked in astonishment.
That seems quite a remarkable talent.
I always could understand that kind of thing better than I can understand people. Zed grunted a brief laugh. I think you understand people more than you admit to. She only smiled. All right, now listen to me, he said. You will not only need to remember a great many turns this night. There is more. The only way to get where we are going is through a number of shields. You are not gifted, so the only way for you to pass through those shields is for a gifted person to help you get through. If it ever becomes necessary, Richard can take you through them, like I will take you through tonight. But no matter how well you know the place or how the shields shift, there is no way to get through without having to pass the shields, so you won't be able to get through alone. That means you won't be able to practice the route by yourself.
He shook a finger before her face to make his point.
Don't even think to try to force your way through the shields. To attempt to do so would be fatal.
Rika nodded. I understand. I would have no reason to need to get through without you or Lord Rawl. Zed leaned even closer to her.
On your word and your life?
I have already given you my word and sworn it on my life. That is the way it will be.
Zed closed the matter with a single nod.
Good. Let's go.
With Rika close at his heels, Zed rushed down the narrow stone hall to the left, their way lit by the globe he carried. Glass spheres in brackets in the distance glowed faintly once coming into sight. As they passed them, each brightened at his approach and dimmed as he moved on with the one he had taken. At the first stairway they came to, Zed took it up, knowing that to descend to his destination he first needed to traverse several impassable areas of the lower keep by going higher. They made their way down broad corridors lined with elegant wood paneling and patterned stone floors, and then through several rooms that served as study areas outside nearby libraries. The rooms had dozens of thick carpets, scattered about at various angles among the comfortable chairs. There was ample table space, and there were a number of lamps to provide adequate light for reading. Zed knew because he had spent a great deal of time reading books from the libraries. After passing through a series of plain stone halls that came from various parts of the keep, they at last reached the main artery hallway in the section they had to pass through. The hall was nearly 100 feet tall, with the sloping walls getting closer together at the top. It felt like walking through an immense cleft in the keep. The sun was already down, so the high slits in the stone did little to illuminate the hallway. They did, however, allow the bats out. Every night at dusk, thousands of the bats poured up from hidden, dark, damp places in the keep and made their way out the high slits in the main hallway. At a gilded doorway, Zed turned to Rika.
This passage is shielded. Take my hand and you will be able to pass.
She didn't hesitate. Zed went through the shield first. The shield produced a gentle tingling sensation against his skin along the plane of the opening. When he turned back toward her and pulled her hand through that plane of the shield at the doorway, she flinched.
It won't hurt you as long as I hold on to you, he assured her. Shall I continue?
She nodded. It's just so cold. The feel of it surprised me, that's all. Holding her hand tightly, he drew her the rest of the way through the doorway. Once through, she vigorously rubbed her arms. What would have happened had I tried to go through without you?
It's hard to say, since different shields do different things. But let's just say that you wouldn't have made it through. This one has no preliminary warning field, so it may not be fatal. There are a number of shields we will have to pass through that would take the flesh right off your bones. Those kind give ample warning, though.
She didn't look too pleased to hear it, but she made no protest. Mord Sith didn't like magic, so he knew she was putting in a great effort to suppress her natural resistance. The gilded doorway led down a hall of white marble all around, the floors, walls, and ceiling. The white color was designed to prevent certain gambits of magic that used conjuring, involving color to trick the shield at either end of the hall. At the far end, Zed helped Rika through the shield, this one using heat rather than cold. Once clear of the hall, they went down several flights of dusty black marble steps. At the bottom of the steps, he led her down the left of three forks.
The sphere he carried provided a bubble of light around them as they raced through the roughly hewn stone tunnel that took them into simple rooms that were made of simple stone blocks. Most of the rooms had one or two doorways, but some had three or even four openings that led to other rooms. Some were reached by going up a short flight of stairs to yet more rooms. A number of rooms were either up or down only a step or two. Most of the rooms, though, were level with one another. The sizes of the rooms varied little, and not a single one had any furniture whatsoever. Some of the rooms were plastered to make the walls smooth, and a number of those were painted, although the chipped, peeling paint was so faded that the colors were barely discernible, leaving them all looking a similar dingy color, as if dust had been settling in them for centuries. When Zed had been a boy, he had been lost in the maze of rooms for an entire day. The place was so undisturbed that there were still faint footprints evident in the fine dirt coating on the floors. After going through a seemingly endless series of rooms, they finally emptied into a broad corridor of coarse gray granite blocks. While the corridor was wide, the ceiling was so low that they had to bend down slightly so as not to bump their heads. It was a place that, while empty and simple-looking, had always felt ominous to Zed. Around a corner, iron brackets holding more of the glass spheres brightened as they passed, and then faded as they continued on. In several places, utilitarian stone stairwells emptied into the low corridor. Several other taller halls branched off the main passageway. At the end of the broad, low hall, they finally entered a major passageway that was plastered and painted a sandy color. Reliefs of pillars were spaced down the passage, giving it a grander appearance. When they reached the middle, Zed finally paused. He pointed up at the ceiling.
"See there? That iron grate overhead that lets the keep breathe? Let's fresh air down here."
She peered up at the ornate grate.
"Is that a book?"
Within the design, crafted from the iron bars, was the outline of an open book. The design, intended as a quick visual reference, denoted a section of the keep that contained a number of libraries.
"Yes, the grate will help you remember that this is where you must turn. This corridor with that grate above is a main trunk of passageways. There are a number of ways down to this place, and from here you can go by various routes to nearly anywhere in the keep. But here, under this grate, you must turn down this hall."
He gestured toward a small hallway.
"It's the only way to get to where we are going."
Zed watched her as she looked around at her surroundings and once more checked the grate overhead. When she was sure and had nodded, they started down a small side hall. The hall contained a series of rooms that Zed believed were once used for maintenance supplies. He knew that one of the rooms still had a number of tools. Beyond, at the end of the hall, were a few roughly constructed rooms made of stone, followed by small square passageways running off in several directions. At the end of the center passageway, they came to a warren of short runs through low service shafts, taking them on a winding route that changed levels by a few feet from time to time. They passed empty rooms and rusted iron doors that stood closed. Cobwebs clogged the shafts in places. In other places, sections of hall that were several feet lower held stagnant water. The rotting carcasses of rats floated in the fetid water. Without a word, they waded through to reach higher ground beyond. When they reached a spiral stone staircase beyond the maze, they descended into the inky darkness, the silent sphere bringing harsh light and shadows to places that had not been lit for years. The stairs were tiny, only large enough for a single body at a time to slip downward. It felt rather like being swallowed down the gullet of some stone monster. At the bottom of the spiral stairs, the light cast harsh shadows down roughly cut passageways that were inspection shafts for part of the keep's foundation. Flecks of quartz in stone foundation blocks the size of small palaces sparkled when the light fell across them. Zed led Rika to the narrow stairs that descended down beside the face of that glittering foundation wall. They both peered over the edge of that slit in the ground before starting down. At the bottom, they followed the narrow slit along the base of the foundation blocks. The stone rose up into the darkness, the sparkling quartz above looking like stars. To the right was a roughly cut wall of crumbling rock. If that softer wall were to collapse, they would be buried alive where no one would ever search for them. The foundation in this part of the keep was kept clear of the soft surrounding rock so that it could move a little if it had to. The foundation blocks had been set down into the harder bedrock below. The narrow slit also provided an areaway for inspection of the foundations. Zed had always thought it remarkable that he had never found any block that was failing. There were some that had cracks, but those were said not to be structural problems. When they came to another narrow flight of stairs at the end of the slit, they again went down deeper into the pitch black cut. "Is there any end to this?" Rika asked. Zed looked back over his shoulder, the glowing sphere casting her face in harsh yellow light. "We're deep in the mountain and getting closer to one of the side slopes. We still have quite a ways to go." She simply nodded, resigned to however far it was. "Do you think you can get this far, providing you have me or Richard to get you through the shields?" There had been a number of shields, some she had not liked going through. For one without the protection of the gift, it was in places a very uncomfortable experience, even with Zed helping her. "I think so," she said. In the lower inspection channels, they came to round, tile-lined tunnels that, when need be, also served as drains. Zed entered the complex of tunnels, taking intersections that he remembered since he was a boy. Dripping water echoed through the passages. It was cold enough to see their breath in the humid air. Water dripped between the tiles in places, making the tunnel slick. At various places, right in the middle of nowhere in the tunnels, they encountered powerful shields that he helped her pass through. Several were so strong that they gave off preliminary warnings long in advance. Zed had to wrap his arms around her in order to protect her enough to get her safely through. "There's a lot of rats down here," Rika said. Zed could hear them squeaking by the hundreds all through the honeycombed passageways. The little beasts seemed to scatter before the light could fully illuminate them, so they were in evidence by sound, not by sight. Except the dead ones.
"Yes. Are you afraid of rats?"
She halted and scowled at him. "No one likes rats."
"Can't argue with you about that."
At each intersection, Zed pointed out to her the way they had to go. He couldn't imagine how she was ever going to remember the way. He hoped it never became necessary. He hoped to be the one to show Richard. As a boy, Zed had used tracers of magic to learn his way through. Rika paid close attention and watched each of the dark intersections they came to. He was sure that it was more than she had bargained for, and that she would not be able to remember her way. He thought that perhaps he would take her through several more times in order to help her get it all mapped out in her head. After that, he would test her and let her lead the way down. After what seemed like an endless journey working their way ever lower, they finally entered a colossal room, an immense cave-like chamber that was hollowed out from the interior of the mountain. The granite quarried out of the mountain down in this place had provided some of the stone for the foundation. The quarry left from the work had left behind the huge room. In some places around the sides, the builders of the keep had left fat pillars of stone in place to hold up what they apparently had found to be weaker areas of the ceiling. In spots around the room, there were broad veins of obsidian, a black glassy rock that was unsuitable for building material. Zed had seen it used in a few places in the palace, mostly for decoration. In the glow of the light from the sphere, the surface of the obsidian showed the shiny curved arcs left by being chipped away with chisels, leaving it looking like dazzling fish scales. The center of the gigantic room, where the rock was the hardest, was vaulted to a height of over 250 feet. From the stone evidence, it appeared that the workers had started at the top, taking out huge blocks of stone right under what was the present ceiling. They then began quarrying the next lower level of rock until they eventually had hollowed out the cave-like room. The different levels of galleries around the side were just tall enough and just wide enough between the large square columns for the foundation blocks to be hauled through. Beyond the room were ramps where the blocks had been eased down to the lower parts of the foundation.
"See there, across the room?"
Zed asked, pointing at an enormous dark corridor to which he knew the surrounding ramps led.
"That was constructed first. It's the main channel where the foundation blocks were transported from this room to the foundation all along that section of the keep. Look at how the floor is worn by the work."
The floor leading into the yawning dark chasm was worn so smooth that it almost looked as if it had been polished.
"Why didn't we come that way? It would have been a much shorter route."
He was impressed that she realized that the primary passageway ran in the direction from which they had come. The stone blocks for the foundation would not have taken the circuitous route they had.
"You're right. It would have been shorter, but there are shields there that I can't pass. Since I can't get in there because of those shields, I don't know what is in there, but I suspect that the builders probably created rooms in there that contain things that must be protected. I can't really think of any other reason for those shields."
"Why can't you pass them? You are first wizard."
"The wizards of that time had both sides of the gift. Richard is the first in thousands of years to be born with the subtractive side as well as the additive. Shields with subtractive magic are deadly, and are typically reserved for the most dangerous places, or the places that have exceptionally important items they were most concerned about protecting."
Zed led Rika across the vast room by a route that kept them close to the outer wall. He rarely came down to this room, and so he had to watch the stone wall carefully as they made their way around. When he reached the place he was looking for, he snatched Rika's arm and pulled her to a stop.
"This is it."
Rika blinked as she looked around. To the inexperienced eye, it looked like the same as the rest of the room.
"This is what?"
"The secret place."
It looked like the rest of the huge room. Everywhere, the walls were scarred with the gouges left by tools used by workers thousands of years before. Zed held up the glass sphere so she could see where he pointed.
"Here. See that gouge up high? The one going at this angle, following the fissure, and a little fatter in the middle? Slip your left hand into it. There's a cleft in the back of the gouge, deeper into the fissure."
Rika frowned at him, but then stood up on her tiptoes and slid her hand into the groove up to her knuckles.
"There's a lip in the rock down here," he said. "I used it when I was smaller. If you can't reach, step up on the edge."
"No, I got it," she said. "Now what?"
"You're only halfway in. Put your hand in deeper."
She wiggled her fingers and worked her hand in farther until it was in up to her wrist.
"That's as far as it will go. It's solid where my fingertips are."
"Move your longest finger up and down until you find a hole."
She made a face as she worked her fingers.
"Got it."
Zed took her right hand and guided it into a similar gouge in another part of the same fissure down at waist level.
"Find a hole in the back of this one as well. When you do, push a finger firmly into both holes."
She made a little sound deep in her throat with the effort.
"Found it. I've got them both. I'm pushing."
"All right now. As you push with both fingers, put your right foot up here on the wall, right on the other side of this chink, and give it a good shove."
She frowned at him, but did as he said. Nothing happened.
"Can't you push any harder than that? Don't tell me that you aren't as strong as a skinny old man."
She shot him a scowl and then used her grip in the handholds for leverage as she grunted with effort and gave the wall a good shove with her boot. Suddenly, the face of the rock began moving away. Zed urged Rika to step back. They both watched as a section of the wall silently slid back, as if it were a massive door, which was exactly what it was. Despite its monumental weight, it was so perfectly balanced that once the two finger latches were released, it pivoted with nothing more than a stout shove.
"Dear spirits,"
Rika whispered, as she leaned toward the opening and peered into the dark maw,
"how did you ever find such a place?"
I found it as a child. Actually, I found the other end. Once I came through into here, I knew where this spot was, and I took careful note so that I was able to find it again. The first few times I couldn't find it, so I had to come through again.
Well, what is it?
When I was a boy, it was my salvation. It was the way I was able to sneak back into the keep without having to come across the bridge and in the front, like everyone else.
She suspiciously arched an eyebrow. You must have been a troublesome child. Zed smiled.
I have to admit that there were those who would agree with that. This place served me well. I was also able to get in here when the Sisters of the Dark had taken the keep. They only knew to guard the front entrance. They, like everyone else alive, didn't know this place existed.
So this is what you wanted to show me? A secret way into the keep?
No, that's by far the least important or remarkable thing about this place. Come on, and I'll show you.
Her suspicion flared again.
Just what kind of place is it?
Zed held up the sphere of light as he leaned toward her and whispered,
Beyond is eternal night, the passage of the dead.
Chapter 35. The distant howl of a wolf woke Richard from a dead sleep. The forlorn cry echoed through the mountains, but went unanswered. Richard lay on his side in the surreal light of false dawn, idly listening, waiting, for a return cry that never came. Try as he might, he couldn't seem to open his eyes for longer than the span of a single slow heartbeat, much less gather the energy to lift his head. Shadowy tree limbs appeared to move about in the murky darkness. Richard gasped as he fully awoke. He awoke angry. He was lying on his back. His sword lay across his chest, one hand clutching the scabbard, the other gripping the hilt so hard that the letters of the word truth were pressed painfully into his palm on one side and his fingertips on the other. The sword of truth was pulled partway out of its scabbard. Its anger, too, had partly slipped its bounds. The first faint traces of dawn were just beginning to silently steal through the forested mountainside. The thick woods were quiet and still. Richard slid the blade back into its scabbard and sat up, laying the sword down beside him on his bedroll. He drew his legs up and put his elbows on his knees as he ran his fingers back through his hair. His heart still raced from the sword's rage. It had stolen into him without his conscious awareness or direction, but he wasn't surprised or alarmed. It was hardly the first time he had begun to draw the sword as he'd remembered that fateful morning while slipping the bonds of sleep. Sometimes he woke to find that he'd pulled the blade completely free. Why did he keep having that memory as he awoke? He knew all too well the reason. That was the morning he had awakened to find Kaylin missing. It was the terrible memory of the morning she'd disappeared. It was a waking nightmare about the nightmare that had become his life, and yet he knew that there was something about it that kept making it go through his mind. He had been over it 1,000 times, but he couldn't figure out what was so meaningful about that particular memory. The wolf waking him had been a bit odd, but that didn't seem so strange that it would keep haunting him. Richard looked around in the deep gloom, but he didn't see Kara. Off through the thick stands of trees, he could just make out the faint stain of red streaking the rim of the eastern sky. The slash of color almost looked like blood seeping through a gash in the slate-black sky beyond the perfectly still trees. He was bone-weary from the relentless pace of their wild ride up from deep in the old world. They had been stopped a number of times by patrolling soldiers scattered throughout the Midlands and by occupying troops. It was by no means the main force of the Imperial Order, but they had been trouble enough. Once they'd let Kara and Richard, posing as a stone carver and his wife, go on their way to a job Richard had invented for the glory of the Order. The rest of the times, the two of them had had to fight their way out of the situation. Those encounters had been bloody. He'd needed more sleep. They had gotten very little on their journey, but as long as Kaylin was missing, they couldn't afford to sleep any more than was absolutely necessary. He didn't know how much time he had to find her, but he didn't intend to waste any of it. He refused to believe that his time had long since run out. One of the horses had died of exhaustion not long ago. He couldn't remember exactly when. Another had come up lame a while back, and they'd had to abandon it. Richard would worry about finding more horses later. There were more important concerns at hand. They were close to Agadon Reach, Shota's home. For the last 2 days, they had been climbing steadily into the formidable mountains that ringed the Reach. As he stretched his aching, tired muscles, he again tried to think of how he would convince Shota to help him. She had helped him before, but that was no guarantee she would help him this time. Shota could be difficult, to say the least. There were people who were so terrified of the witch woman that they wouldn't even say her name aloud. Zed had told him once that Shota never told you anything you wanted to know without also telling you something that you didn't want to know. Richard couldn't really imagine what he didn't want to know, but he understood quite clearly what it was he did want to know, and he intended Shota to tell him anything she knew about Kaelin's disappearance or where she might be. If Shota refused, there was going to be trouble. As his anger heated, he realized that he felt the cool, tingling touch of mist on his face. It was then that he also noticed something moving in the trees. He squinted in an effort to see in the darkness. It couldn't be the breeze moving the leaves. There was no wind in the silent pre-dawn woods. Shadowy tree limbs appeared to move about in the murky darkness. There had been no wind at all that morning either. Richard's sense of alarm rose to match his heart rate. He stood in his bedroll. Something was slipping through the trees. It wasn't disturbing the branches or brush the way a person or an animal would. It was higher up, maybe at eye level. There simply wasn't enough light for him to see what it was. As dark and still as the morning was, though, he couldn't be certain that there really was something there. It might have been his imagination. Being this close to Shota certainly was enough to make him uneasy. While she might have helped him in the past, she had also caused him no end of trouble. But if nothing was there in the trees, then why was his skin tingling with dread? And what was the almost imperceptible sound he heard, like a soft hiss? Without taking his eyes off the dark woods, Richard reached out and put his fingertips against a nearby spruce for balance as he carefully squatted down enough to pick up his sword from where it lay on the bedroll. As he quietly slipped the baldric over his head, he tried to focus his eyes in the darkness out ahead of him to see what, if anything, was moving. Whatever was moving, it couldn't be much. Yet he was more and more convinced by the moment that it really was something. The most disconcerting aspect of it was the way it moved. It didn't move in short bursts, like a bird flitting from branch to branch, or in rapid start-and-stop spurts like a squirrel. It didn't even move with the stealth of a snake that glided, then paused, then glided some more. This moved not only fluidly and quietly, but continuously. The horses off through the trees in a corral Richard had constructed by using saplings to fence off the end of a narrow chasm snorted and stamped their hooves. A flock of birds in the distance suddenly burst from their roost and took to wing. For the first time, Richard realized that the cicadas were silent. Richard detected the faint scent of something out of place in the forest. Carefully, quietly, he sniffed the air, trying to place the scent. He thought it might be a whiff of something burning. The odor wasn't anywhere near as strong as a fire would be. It almost smelled like a campfire, but they had no campfire. Richard hadn't wanted to take the time or to chance attracting attention. Kara had a lantern with a light shield around it, but it didn't smell like the lantern flame. He scanned the woods all around, checking for Kara. She was on watch, so she was probably nearby. But Richard didn't see her anywhere. Surely she wouldn't have gone far, especially not after the attack the morning Kaelin had disappeared. She was all too worried about his safety and knew that this time, if he was shot with an arrow, there would be no Nikki to save his life. No, Kara would be close. His instinct was to call out for her, but he suppressed the urge. He first wanted to find out what was happening, to find out what was wrong, before he called out an alarm. An alarm would also alert any adversary that he was already aware of them.
It was better to let an opponent, especially an opponent sneaking up on you, believe that they had not been detected. As he studied the surrounding area, Richard thought that there was something not right about the woods. He couldn't put his finger on it, but they looked wrong. He supposed that he had that impression in part because of the curious burning smell. It was still too dark to be able to see anything clearly, but from what he was able to see, the branches didn't seem to look right. There was something odd about the pine boughs, the leaves. They didn't seem to be hanging naturally. He remembered all too well coming to Agden Reach the first time. Farther back down the mountains, he had been attacked by some strange creature. As he had been frantically fighting it off, Shota had snatched Kaelin and taken her down into the Reach. That attack had been in the guise of a stranger trying to lead him to an ambush. The creature had finally been frightened off, and this time there was no such stranger. Still, that didn't mean that such a creature, having failed before, might not this time try a different approach. He remembered, too, that his sword had been all that kept the monstrous thing at bay. As quietly as possible, Richard slowly drew his sword from its sheath. In an attempt to keep it from making any noise, he pinched the sides of the blade right at the throat of the scabbard, letting the steel slide between his finger and thumb as it slipped out of the scabbard. Even so, the blade hissed ever so softly as it came free. The sword's rage, too, slipped its bounds. As he steadily drew his sword, he began cautiously moving toward the spot where he thought he saw movement. Whenever he was looking elsewhere, he thought, out of the corner of his eye, he could see a faint shape of something ahead of him. But when he then looked directly at the place, he couldn't see anything. He didn't know if it was a trick of his sight, or if there was nothing to see. He was well aware that in dark conditions, the center of the eye's vision was not nearly as good as the peripheral vision. Being a guide and having spent a great deal of time outdoors at night, he had often used the technique of not looking directly at what it was that he needed to see, but instead gazing at least 15 degrees away from it. At night, the peripheral vision worked better than direct vision. Since leaving his woods, where he had been a guide, he had learned that the knack of focusing his awareness to specific places in his peripheral vision while not turning his eyes there was invaluable in sword fighting. Before he had gone 3 steps, his pant leg came up against something that shouldn't have been there. It was a light contact, almost like a low branch. He halted immediately before putting any pressure on it. He smelled something again, only stronger. It smelled like scorched cloth. He then felt the intense heat against his shin. Quickly and without making a sound, he drew back. For the life of him, Richard could not figure out what it was he had touched. It was not anything natural that he could think of. He might have suspected that it was a tripwire of some sort to warn anyone hidden in the trees nearby if he moved, but a tripwire wouldn't burn him the way this thing had. Whatever it was, it pulled at his pants, like it was sticky when he drew away. When he backed free of it, the sleek movement in the trees abruptly halted, as if it had detected the contact against his pant leg being broken. The dead silence ringing in his ears was almost painful. The mist was too fine to make any sound hitting the leaves, and the moisture that the pine needles combed from the damp air was not enough to collect and drip very much. Besides, the sound he had heard had been something different than rainwater. Richard focused his concentration into the dark shadows, trying to make out what it was that had stopped moving. Then it started in again, only more rapidly, as if with more purpose. The soft, silky sound whispered among the limbs of the trees in a way that reminded him of the blade of an ice skate gliding across smooth ice. As Richard backed away, something caught his other pant leg. It was sticky, just like the thing that he'd snagged before. It too felt hot. As he turned to see what it was that was against his pant leg, something brushed his arm just above his elbow. He didn't have on a shirt, and the instant the sticky thing touched him, it burned into his flesh. He jerked his arm back and then stepped away from the thing touching his pant leg. With the hand holding the sword, he silently comforted the searing pain on his left arm. Warm blood ran down over his fingers. His anger, and the anger flooding into him from the sword,
together threatened to overpower his sense of caution. He turned around, trying to see in the darkness what was there that should not be there. The razor-thin red slash of light at the horizon glinted off his blade as he turned, making the polished metal look as if it was coated in blood to match the very real blood covering his hand on the hilt. The shadows around him were beginning to pull inward toward him. Whatever it was, as it moved closer, it caught limbs and boughs all around him, gently pushing leaves and brush aside as it advanced. Richard suspected that the soft hissing sound he heard was actually the sound of vegetation being scorched when it was touched. The smell of burning leaves he had first detected began to make sense to him. He just didn't have any idea what could be causing it or how. He would doubt his judgment, doubt that such a thing could be real, were it not for the fierce burning pain of its touch. He certainly wasn't imagining the blood running down his arm. Instinctively, Richard knew that he was running out of time. Chapter 36. Richard swiftly but silently raised the sword before himself in preparation for an attack. What kind of attack, he wasn't sure, but he fully intended to be ready. He touched the cold steel of the blade to his sweat-slick forehead. He spoke the words, "Blade be true this day," in a softly inaudible whisper, fully committing himself and his sword to whatever was necessary. A few fat drops of rain splashed against his bare chest. At first sporadic, the fitful rain gradually began to increase a bit. The soft whispering sound of raindrops against the thick canopy of leaves began to spread through the quiet of the woods. Richard blinked drops of water from his eyelashes. At the sound of the limbs moving, he then heard the sudden rush of footsteps starting to run toward him. He recognized Kara's unique gait. Apparently, she had been patrolling around the perimeter of their campsite and had heard the same sounds as he had. Knowing Kara, he wasn't in the least surprised that she had been paying close attention. But under the cover of the sound of the rain all around him, Richard could hear branches and limbs slowly pulling past one another. Here and there, a few small twigs snapped as something drew in closer all around him. Something touched his left arm. He flinched back a step, pulling his arm away from the gummy contact. The burn throbbed painfully. Warm blood now trickled down his arm in two places. He felt something catch the back of his pant leg. He tugged his leg away from the sticky contact. Kara crashed through the trees not far away. Subtle, she was not. She threw open a small door on the shield around the lantern she carried, letting a weak beam of light fall across the campsite. Richard was able to see what he thought looked like a strange dark web of something crisscrossed all around him, woven through trees, shrubs, limbs, and brush. It looked like thick cords of some sort, but organic and gummy. He couldn't imagine what it was or exactly how it had gotten itself everywhere around him. "Lord Rawl, are you all right?" "Yes, stay where you are." "What's going on?" "I'm not sure yet." The sound came closer as the still, dark strands all around him again began to draw tighter. One of them pressed against his back. He flinched away, spun, and slashed with the sword. As soon as he cut it, the whole of the tangle all around him tensed and contracted in toward him. Kara threw open the entire shield around the lantern, hoping to see better. Richard could suddenly see that the glistening threads were nearly cocooning him. He even saw lines of the stuff crisscrossing overhead. With as close in as it all was, he was running out of clear space to maneuver. With a flash of comprehension, he understood the silken sound he had heard at first. The fluid, continuous movement was something spinning the filaments around him, as if he were a meal for a spider. These filaments, though, were as thick as his wrist. What exactly they were, he had no idea. What he did know was that when they had touched him, sticking to his pant leg, his left arm, and his back, it delivered painful burns. He could see Kara and her lantern as she dodged this way and that, looking for a way to get through to him. "Kara, stay back. It will burn you if you touch it." "Burn?" "Yes, like acid, I think, and it's sticky. Keep away from it, or you're liable to get caught in it." "Then how are you to get out of the middle of it?" "I'll just have to cut my way out. You stay there and let me come to you." When the strands pulled in tighter to the left side, he finally swung the sword and struck out at them. The blade flashed in the light of Kara's lantern, slashing through the enveloping tangle of sticky fibers. As they were parted by the blade, they whipped around as if they'd been under tension, some stuck to trees or limbs hanging down like murky moss. In the light of the lantern, he could see the leaves shrivel up, evidently from being burned when they were touched by the strands. Whatever was creating the webs of the stuff, Richard didn't see it. The rain began to come down a little harder as Kara darted from side to side, trying to find a way in. "I think I can..." "No!" he yelled at her. "I told you, keep away from it!" Richard swung the sword at the thick, dark ropes wherever they drew in toward him, trying to check their constriction and weaken their integrity. But he was forced not to do so unless he had no choice, because the sticky strands were beginning to cling to the blade. "I need to help you stop this thing," she called back, impatient to see him free. "You'll just get caught up in it. If you do that, then you can be of no help to me. Stay back. I told you, let me cut my way out and come to you." That, at least, looked to have finally dissuaded her from any immediate attempt to try to fight her way through. She stood half-crouched, lips pressed tight in frustrated fury, a geel in her fist, not knowing what to do, not wanting to go against what he told her and realizing the sense of what he'd said, but at the same time not wanting him to have to fight his way out all by himself. It was a strange, confounding, non-violent kind of battle. There looked to be no rush. The gashes he inflicted didn't seem to cause the thing any pain. The slow, inexorable approach of the surrounding tangle seemed to be trying to lull him into holding back, inasmuch as there appeared to be plenty of time to analyze the situation. Despite that quiet appearance, that deceptive calm, Richard found the implacable advance of the surrounding trap alarming in the extreme. Not wanting to give in to that appeal to inaction, Richard swung the sword again, driving into the walls of the tangled web. He could see more of the strands appearing in the woods all around him, even as he tried to fight his way through it. It was reinforcing itself, adding a backdrop, even as he slashed the part closest to him. For every dozen strands he cut, two dozen more enfolded him. He kept scanning the forest, trying to see what was creating the growing entanglement so that he could attack the cause and not the result. Try as he might, he couldn't see a lead end or what was spinning the morass. But the viscous ropes of it were moving swiftly through the trees and brush, the strands lengthening and multiplying all the time, endlessly adding to and forming more of themselves all around him. Even though it seemed like he had ample time to figure a way out, he knew that such a notion was a fool's empty hope. He was well aware that his time was swiftly running out. His level of alarm rose steadily. His burned flesh throbbed in pain, reminding him of what fate awaited him if he didn't get out. There would come a point, he knew, when action would no longer be possible. He knew that once the intricate trap contracted enough, he would die, but he doubted that it would be a quick death. As the net reinforced itself around him and moved inward, Richard attacked, slashing furiously, making a mad effort to hack his way through the tightening entrapment. Every time he swung the sword, though, the blade was further ensnared in the tacky substance that made up the strands. The more of it he cut, the more of it stuck to what was already clinging tenaciously to his sword. The unwieldy mass was getting heavy and making it ever more difficult to cut through the wall. As he tried to hack and slash his way through, a knot of the filaments not only continued to tangle together in a clotted mass around his blade, but began to adhere to the wall of the trap, making it a formidable task just to move the sword. He felt like a fly caught in a spider web. It took a mighty effort to pull the sword away from the wall of the strands. They, in turn, sticking to the sword, stretched and pulled away in gummy strings. This was the first time that Richard had ever encountered an adversary of any sort that gave the sword such difficulty. He had cut through armor and iron bars with it, but this sticky substance, even though it yielded to being cut, simply fell away and stuck to everything. He remembered Addie once asking him which he thought was stronger, teeth or tongue. She had made the point that the tongue was stronger, even though it was much softer,
and would endure long after the teeth gave out. Although it was in a different context, it had a frightening significance in this instance as well. Some of the gooey string stretched out and stuck to his pant legs. As he pulled his sword back, a string fell across his right arm. He cried out in pain and dropped to his knees.
"Lord Rawl,
stay there," he called before she had a chance to try again to reach him. "I'm all right, just stay where you are." Snatching up a handful of leaves, bark, and dirt, he used the debris to protect his hand as he pulled the dark, clinging substance from his arm. The searing pain caused him to nearly forget everything else except getting it off. As the surrounding fibrous structure grew tighter, the thick strands pulled small saplings over. Branches snapped. Limbs were torn from trees. The woods were filled with a pungent, burning smell. Even with the fury of the sword storming up through him, pulling his anger forth, Richard realized that he was losing the battle. Wherever he cut it, a great many of those cut strands fell back to stick together with others and close the gap. Despite his cutting through the snarled mass of the webs, the net only tangled together and stuck to itself, creating an ever more tightly woven web. His calm frustration began to give way to the panicked realization that he was trapped. That fear powered his muscles as he put all his effort into swinging his sword. He could imagine the strange dark mass miring him, burning his flesh, congealing as it enfolded itself around him, eventually to suffocate him if it didn't first kill him by scorching the flesh off his bones. With all his might, Richard brought the sword down over and over, slashing through a wall of the stuff. More strands beyond those he cut caught up the ones he had severed as they whipped around and fell back. The ones he cut only served to cross over strands beyond and reinforce them. He was not simply failing, but in so doing, helping to strengthen his executioner.
"Lord Rawl, I need to get to you."
Kara clearly understood the deadly nature of the threat he was under, and wanted to find a way to help get him out of the trouble. And like him, she didn't really have any idea what to do.
"Kara, listen to me. If you get tangled in it, you'll die. Stay away from it, and whatever you do, don't touch it with your Aegil. I'll figure something out."
"Then hurry up and do it before it's too late."
As if he wasn't trying.
"Just give me a minute to think."
Panting, trying to catch his breath, he put his back against the protection of a large spruce tree close to his bedroll as he tried to figure out what to do to escape. There was not much room left around the tree, and not much time before that space too would be gone. Blood ran down his arms from the wounds where the dark substance had touched him. Those wounds burned and throbbed, making it difficult to think. He needed a way to get across the sticky tangle, to get out of the middle of it before it finally captured him for good. And then it came to him. Use the sword for what the sword could do best. Without wasting another moment, Richard stepped away from the tree, spun around, drew back, and with all his might swung the sword as hard as he could. Knowing that his life depended on it, he put every bit of fury and energy behind the blade, driving it with all his power. The tip whistled as it came around with lightning speed. The blade crashed through the tree with a loud boom that sounded like a lightning strike and did just as much damage. The tree's trunk shattered. Jagged splinters flew everywhere. Long fragments spiraled through the air. Smaller chips and a shower of bark were netted by the sticky tangle beyond. The mighty spruce groaned as the towering crown pulled itself through the tangled canopy above as the tree began to topple. With gathering speed, it plunged through the tight stand of trees, ripping thick branches from other trees as the great weight of the spruce dropped through the crowded forest. As the tree fell, it ripped the strands where the trunk rose through the tangled web above him, pulling gummy ropes along with it, and then it crashed down atop the entanglement of sticky strands, whipping them down against the ground, burying them under the trunk and the thick thatch of limbs. Before the web had time to reform or heal itself and close the yawning gap, Richard leaped up onto the trunk, even as it was still rebounding from hitting the ground. He held his arms out and crouched for balance. The rain was picking up, and the trunk of the tree was slippery.
as the great trunk bounced and settled to the ground and limbs, bark, branches, needles, and leaves still rained down on him, Richard used the opportunity to race across the length of the spruce, using it like a bridge to cross the sticky net. Panting, he reached Kara, free at last of the trap. Kara, having seen him coming, had climbed up on a stout limb to be ready to help him across. She seized his arm to keep him from falling on the wet bark as he ran through the snarl of branches. "What in the world is going on?" Kara asked through the roar of the downpour as she helped him down to the ground. Richard was still trying to catch his breath. "I have no idea." "Look," she said, pointing at his sword. The gummy substance still stuck to his sword had begun melting away in the rain. The massive strands tangled all through the woods were also beginning to soften and sag. As strands came apart, the rain beat the net down, pulling yet more of the long, thick fibers from the trees. It dropped to the ground in dark masses, where it hissed in the rain and melted like the first snow of the season, failing to survive as the storm turned back to rain. In the gray dawn, Richard could see the extent of the mass that had woven its way around him. It was an immense snarl. When the tree ripped the weave of the mesh open at the top, it seemed to have undone the integrity of the whole thing, causing its way to tear itself apart and collapse. With the cold rain coming down harder all the time, the dark strands were washed from the branches and brush. They lay on the ground looking like nothing so much as the dark viscera of some great dead monster. Richard wiped his sword on wet bushes and grasses until the sticky substance was all off. The mass on the ground melted away with increasing speed, evaporating into a gathering gray fog. Back in the shadows of the trees, like steam rising from the entrails of a fresh corpse on a winter day, that dark fog slowly lifted from the ground. Carried on a faint breeze that had come up, murky patches drifted away beyond the thick veil of trees. Back in the cover of trees, that dark fog shifted abruptly, in some vague manner that Richard couldn't quite follow, solidifying into an inky black shadow. In a flash, before he could make sense of it, that sinister apparition disintegrated into a thousand fluttering shapes that darted off in every direction, as if a dark phantom were decomposing into the rainy shadows and mist. In an instant, they were gone. A chill ran up Richard's spine. Kara stared in astonishment. "Did you see that?" Richard nodded. "It looked something like what the thing back in Altarang did after it came through the walls after me. It disappeared in much the same way just before it would have had me." "Then it has to be the same beast." In the early morning downpour, Richard surveyed the shadows among the trees all around them. "That would be my guess." Kara, too, watched the woods all around for any sign of threat. "Lucky for us the rain came when it did." "I don't think it was the rain that did it." She wiped water from her eyes. "Then what did?" "I don't know for sure, but maybe just the fact that I escaped its trap. I can't imagine a beast with that kind of power being so easily discouraged, the last time or this time." "I don't have any other ideas. I know someone who might, though." He took Kara by the arm. "Come on, let's get our things together and get out of here." She gestured off through the woods. "You go get the horses. Let me pack up our bedrolls. We can dry them out later." "No, I want us out of this place right now." He quickly pulled a shirt out of his pack along with a cloak to try to keep relatively dry. "We'll leave the horses. With them fenced into a place where they have grass and water, they'll be fine where they are for a while." "But the horses would get us away from here faster." Richard kept an eye on the surrounding woods as he stuffed his arms through the sleeves of his shirt. "We can't take them over the mountain pass. It's too narrow in places, and we can't take horses down into Agadon Reach where Shota lives. They can get a needed rest while we go see the witch woman. Then, when we find out what Shota knows about where Kaelin is, we can come back and get the horses. Maybe Shota will even know how we can get rid of this beast that's following me." Kara nodded. "Makes sense, but I'd rather get out of here as quickly as we can, and horses would help in that." Richard squatted down and started rolling up his sodden bedroll. "I agree with the sentiment,
but the pass is close and the horses can't make it over, so let's just get moving. Like I said, the horses need a rest anyway, or they're not going to be any good to us. Kara stuffed the few things she had out back into her pack. She, too, pulled out a cloak. She lifted the pack by a strap and threw it up onto a shoulder. We'll need to get things out of our saddlebags, back with the horses. Leave them. I don't want to have to carry any more than we must. It would just slow us down. Kara gazed off through the veil of rain. But someone might steal our supplies. Thieves won't come near Shota. She frowned up at him. Why not? Shota and her companion walk these woods. She's a rather intolerant woman. Oh, great, Kara muttered. Richard swung his pack around onto his back and started out. Come on, hurry. She scurried after him. Have you ever considered that maybe the witch woman is more dangerous than the beast? Richard glanced back over his shoulder. You're a regular Little Miss Sunshine this morning, aren't you? Chapter 37. The rain had turned to snow after they'd climbed out of the dense forest and made it into the crooked wood at the transition out of the tree line. Because of the harsh conditions common at that elevation, the stunted trees, mantled in meager vegetation, grew in bizarre, wind-blown shapes. Walking through the crooked wood was like passing among the petrified forms of desiccated souls whose limbs were frozen for all time in tormented stances, as if they had emerged from their graves only to find their feet forever anchored in hallowed ground, preventing them from ever escaping the temporal world. While there were those who would not enter the surreal world of the Crooked Wood without some form of mystical protection, Richard wasn't superstitious about the place. In fact, he considered all such beliefs to be the refuge of the willfully ignorant. Richard saw through the trappings to what lay beneath all superstition, nothing less than the call to surrender to the view of man as helpless in accomplishing his own ends and dealing with the reality of the world around him in order to further his own survival, instead embracing the notion that he existed only at the whim of vague and unknowable forces that can only be persuaded to stay their cruel and merciless impulses if man falls to his knees in supplication, or if they have to enter a spiritual place by carrying the proper fetish. While Richard had always found it eerie being in a crooked wood, he knew what it was and why it had grown to be that way, even if it still felt rather haunting to be in such a place. He was aware that there were basically two ways to deal with that primordial emotion. The superstitious solution was to carry sacred talismans and amulets to ward off spiteful demons and incomprehensible dark forces thought to inhabit such places, hoping that the fates would be persuaded to kindly stay their fickle hand. Even though people proclaimed with complete confidence that such mysterious forces were fundamentally unknowable to mere mortals, they nonetheless passionately believed without evidence that they could be certain that the power of charms would soothe the savage temper of those menacing forces, insisting that faith was all that was necessary, as if faith were a mystical plaster with the power to patch over all the yawning holes in their convictions. Believing in free will, Richard instead chose the second way of dealing with such fear, which was to be watchful, alert, and ready to take responsibility for his own survival and life. At its core, that battle of belief between the cruel fates and free will was his essential disagreement with prophecy and why he discounted it. To choose to believe in fate was at once an admission of free will, and at the same time an abdication of one's responsibility to it. As he and Kara passed through the crooked wood, Richard kept a watchful eye out, but he saw no legendary beasts or vengeful ghosts. Only the wind-borne snow wandered the wood. Having traveled at a breakneck pace for so long in the oppressive heat and humidity of summer, they found that the encounter with bitter cold high up in the mountain pass made the effort of the climb all the more difficult, especially after being drenched by the miserable rain. Despite being fatigued from the altitude, Richard knew that, as wet as they were, they had to keep moving at a brisk pace to keep warm, or the cold could easily overcome them. He was well aware that the seductive song of the cold could entice people to stop and lie down for a rest, luring them to surrender to sleep and the death that waited under its inviting cloak. As Zed had once told him, dead was dead. Richard knew that he would be no less dead from the cold than he would be from an arrow. More than that, though, he and Kara were both eager to put distance between them and the trap that had nearly captured him back at their camp. His burns from the brief contact with his would-be death trap had blistered. He shuddered to think of what had nearly happened. At the same time, he was leery about going to see Shota in her lair at Agadon Reach. The last time he had been in the Reach, she had told him that if he ever came back there, she would kill him. Richard didn't doubt her word or her ability to carry out the threat. Even so, he believed Shota would be his best chance of getting the kind of help necessary to find Kaelin. He was desperate to find someone who could tell him something useful, and after going through a list of things he might do, people he might go to, in the end, he couldn't come up with anyone else who could be as potentially informative as Shota. Nikki hadn't been able to offer any solutions. Zed, he knew, might be able to help him in some ways, and maybe there were others with the capacity to be able to add some piece to the puzzle. But to Richard's mind, when all was said and done, none of them were as likely as Shota to be able to point him in the right direction. That alone made the choice simple. When he glanced up, Richard briefly saw the snow cap through gaps in the driving snow. Some distance off, over the open, broken ground of the steep slope, the trail over the pass would skirt the lower reaches of the mountain's year-round icy mantle. The clouds, laden with moisture, clung to the soaring gray rock. The low trailers of mist and fog dragging past left visibility limited in most places and nearly non-existent in others. It was just as well. The precipitous drop-offs in spots along the infrequently used and increasingly slippery trail offered frightening glimpses down the towering mountainside. When a fresh flight of icy gusts carried curtains of wet snow into their faces, Richard pulled his cloak tight against the buffeting onslaught. Out of the cover of the trees, making their way across the loose scree, they had to lean not only into the steep incline, but into the wind. Richard hunched a shoulder, trying to keep the icy wet sting off his face. Wind-driven snow built a brittle crust on one side of his cloak. With wind howling through the mountain pass, talking was difficult at best. The altitude and the exertion left them both winded and in no condition to be able to easily carry on a conversation. Just getting the air they needed was effort enough, and he could tell by the look on Kara's face that she felt just as nauseated by the altitude as he did. Richard wasn't in the mood to talk anyway. He'd been talking to Kara for days, and it never got him anywhere. Kara, for her part, seemed just as frustrated by his questions as he was by her answers. He knew that she thought his questions were absurd. He thought her answers were. The inconsistencies and gaps in Kara's recollection were at first disappointing and confounding, but eventually they became maddening. Several times he'd had to bite his tongue and remind himself that she was not doing it to be malicious. He knew that if Kara could have honestly said what he wanted to hear, she would have eagerly done so. He knew, too, that if she lied, it would be of no help in getting Kaelin back. He needed the truth. That, after all, was why he was going to see Shota. Richard had systematically gone through a long list of times when Kara had been with him and Kaelin. Kara, though, remembered events that should have been momentous to her in ways that were not consistent with what had really happened. In a number of cases, such as the time he had gone to the Temple of the Winds, Kara simply didn't recall key parts of the circumstances in which Kaelin had been involved. In other instances, Kara remembered events very differently from how they had actually happened. Happened, at least, as Richard remembered them. There were depressing moments when he sank into a despondent fear that it was he who was for some reason the one with the problem. Kara thought that it was he who was remembering things that had never taken place. Although she didn't try to put too fine an edge to her convictions, the more things he brought up, the more she thought his delusions about a fantasy wife were cropping up everywhere in his memory like weeds after a rain.
But Richard's clear memory of events and the way those events were knit tightly together always brought him back to the solid conviction that Kalin was real. Kara's memory about certain incidents was very clear and very different from his, while in regard to other things, her memory was agonizingly fuzzy. That his story of situations was so different from her memory of those same situations only served in Kara's mind to further convince her that he was even more delusional than she had previously realized or feared. While that obviously saddened her, he'd continued to press her. At his and Kalin's wedding, Kara had been the only Mord Sith in attendance. Richard knew that such an event had been significant to her in more ways than one, yet Kara remembered only that she'd gone with him to the Mud People's village. And why did they go there if not for the wedding? Kara said that she didn't know for certain why he'd gone there, but she was sure that he had his reasons. Her duty was to go where he went and protect him, not to question his motive every time he turned around. Richard wanted to pull his hair out. Kara didn't remember that she, Kalin, and Richard had traveled together to the wedding site in the Slough. At the time, Kara had been apprehensive about climbing down into the Slough's well and breathing in what appeared to be living quicksilver. Yet now she had no awareness that Kalin had helped her overcome her anxiety about traveling within such a creature of magic. Kara remembered Zed being there at the Mud People's village, and Shota making a brief appearance. But instead of the witch woman coming to offer Kalin the necklace as a wedding gift and truce, Kara only recalled Shota being there to congratulate Richard on stopping the plague by going to the Temple of the Winds. When Richard questioned Kara about Wizard Marlin, the assassin Jagang had sent, she clearly remembered him coming to kill Richard, but not any of the parts where Kalin had been involved. When he asked how in the world she thought he could have even gotten to the Temple of the Winds in the first place, or how he had been cured of the plague, were it not for Kalin's help, Kara only shrugged and said, "Lord Rall, you're a wizard. You know about such things. I don't. I'm sorry, but I can't tell you how you managed to accomplish astonishing things with your gift. I don't know how magic works. I only know that you did it. I only remember you doing what you had to do in order to make things work out, and they did, so I must be right. I could no more easily tell you how you healed me. I only know that you used your gift and you did it. You were the magic against magic, as is your duty to us. I simply don't recall this woman being any part of it. For your sake, I wish I did, but I don't." For every single instance where Kalin had been present, Kara remembered it either differently or not at all. For every one of those events, she had an answer to explain it away with an alternate version, or, when that would have been impossible, simply didn't recall what he was talking about. To Richard, there were 1,000 little inconsistencies in her version that just didn't add up or make sense. To Kara's mind, it seemed not only simple and clear, but straightforward. To say that it was exasperating trying to convince Kara of the reality of Kalin's existence would not begin to touch the depth of his frustration. Because it was pointless to continue to remember significant events in an effort to try to help her remember, when it never did any good, Richard had lost interest in trying to bring Kara around to reality. She simply didn't recall Kalin.
This is the end of disc number 12. Please insert disc number 13.